This is Dr. Pedro Ramirez, Editor-in-Chief of the International Journal of Gynecological Cancer. And today I have the great pleasure of speaking to Dr. Maike Onk, who is at the University Medical Center Groningen in the Netherlands. And the reason for this podcast is a discussion on our publication, the European Society of Gynecological Oncology Guidelines for the Management of Patients with Vulvar Cancer, the update of 2023. So, Maike, thank you so much for accepting our invitation, and thank you for discussing this excellent manuscript.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
Excellent. So I wanted to, we have quite a few questions and hopefully we'll get through all of them, but I wanted to start by discussing as to how did you put together these guidelines and what was the methodology and strategic planning for the five-step process?
Well, the five-step process is used in all ESCO guidelines, and our previous guidelines were published in 2017. And first, we selected the members for a working group, and we had to renew at least half of them. That's half of the old working group, and we selected specialists with all experience in vulvar cancer treatment and also in vulvar cancer research, and all with a different background that people that represented all parts of Europe. And after that, the scientific evidence was updated by a methodologist per topic. So per diagnosis, treatment, adjuvant treatment, palliative treatment. And the scientific evidence was judged to whether it included new information that needed to be taken into account for the update of the guideline, and to ensure that all the statements were evidence-based, the current literature was reviewed and updated from September 2015 until 2022. And after that, we formulated recommendations based on this literature. And after that, that's also an important step in the process. All the guidelines were reviewed by an international external review process that included over 200 physicians and patients. And they all give their comments on the guidelines. And after that, we came together again and went through all the comments to see what we think would be the best recommendation based on the evidence there is, and sometimes also expert opinion based, because evidence in vulvar cancer is rare on some topics.
Yes, so quite a massive undertaking. Again, congratulations to you and the group. And having been part of these guidelines in the past, I know it is a significant amount of work. So once again, congratulations. I wanted to start getting into some of the points and the recommendations. You know, the guidelines suggest centralizing care in specialized centers. How would you define a specialized center for vulvar cancer? And also one of the questions that follows up, and you know, certainly for vulvar cancer, often this is impacting elderly patients who may want to be treated closer to home. So would you apply the same strict criteria as in other diseases?
Well, we know vulvar cancer is a rare disease. And on the other hand, you can argue that the surgery we perform for vulvar cancer is not too difficult. However, I think you can fail at many stages of the treatment, starting with the selection of patients for the central node procedure, the interpretation of the lymphoscintigram, the central node procedure, the pathological assessment of the specimens. And we have seen that when you do not strictly adhere to the guidelines, for example, to the inclusion criteria of the central node procedure, the groin recurrence rate will increase, and thereby more patients will have groin recurrences and have a high risk of dying of the disease. And in my country, in the Netherlands, we say a specialized center should at least treat 20 vulvar cancer patients per year. But I think that's not too much. And also when you realize that in those centers, maybe three or four, or maybe even five different doctors are treating these patients, is still little experience per doctor. So in my opinion, the number should be even higher. And we also see, you say, many elderly patients that they have to travel for. But I think you need a good organized referral network in your region, in which you make agreements on preoperative workup, on referral, on treatment and follow up. And you can perform close to home what can be performed there, like diagnosis and the imaging, but refer to a specialized center for the surgical procedure. And afterwards, you can do follow up close at home again. Huh? So you make it as easy as possible for the elderly patients. And in my experience, they don't mind traveling a few hours longer for good quality surgery, as long as what can be performed close to home will be performed close to home.
Yeah, excellent points. And Micah, you put some emphasis on pathology and the reporting of the pathology and the details that should be included. Can you share what those are?
Yeah, we think it's important to have a structured pathology report. And we have mentioned in the guidelines which items should be included. And we know that to give the right care to vulvar cancer patients, you should at least know the histological type, because squamous cell cancer is treated differently than a basal cell carcinoma. And you should know the depth of invasion and the tumor diameter. Also, margin distance, presence of premalignant disease, presence of LVSI and perineural invasion also gives important information, but will probably not change your primary treatment. And from the lymph nodes and the sentinel nodes, you should know whether there are metastases or not. And for the sentinel node, also the size of the metastasis and the presence of extranodal tumor extension, because that will also alter your primary treatment. And nowadays, vulvar cancer is classified in HPV dependent and HPV associated. And if you want to correctly classify the tumor, you need immunohistochemistry for P16 as a surrogate marker for HPV infection, or molecular testing for HPV. And we think the P53 immunohistochemistry should also be recommended, but you do not need it for treatment. And it's also to know whether the tumor is HPV related or not, does currently not change your treatment, but we know it is important for example, for prognosis. And we are doing much research here also to see if maybe in the future you can have different follow-up regimens, or to also different treatment options for HPV associated and HPV independent disease. So I think it will become more and more important in the future.
Excellent. And now let's talk a little bit more about the preoperative workup. What do the guidelines tell us as to what should be the standard preoperative workup?
Yes, what should be the standard preoperative? That's a short question for an extensive answer, I think. First, of course, you should know your patient. I think you should know the medical history, general assessment, know what the comorbidities are, and you should do the clinical examination and a biopsy of all lesions that are suspicious. And you should also describe your tumor correctly. Yeah? It's important to know the size and the location, the distance to the midline, to know whether you should treat one or both groins, the distance to structures like the urethra, clitoris, and the anus. And that's necessary to correctly inform your patient on the treatment and the consequences of the treatment you will be given. And when you look at the imaging you need preoperative, you don't need it in microinvasive disease. But in macroinvasive disease, you need imaging to see if there are signs of metastasis. And we know that for patients planned for the sentinel node procedure, studies have shown that CT scanning does not give more important information compared to ultrasound alone, and that ultrasound alone is probably the best way to correctly do the imaging for your groins. Because for people that undergo the sentinel node procedure, the most important reasons for imaging is to rule out gross nodal involvement in the ground, in the groins that you cannot feel when you palpate the groins. because we know that can sometimes interfere with a reliable sentinel node procedure. And in all other cases, I think you should do a CT or a PET-CT. Depends where you live around the world, what is the preferred way of imaging. And in advanced disease, you should really individualize what you need. Most often, we do also an MRI then of the pelvis and do a PET-CT to rule out distant metastasis.
Excellent. So now let's talk a little bit about the surgical treatment. And I was wondering if you can talk about surgical treatment of vulvar lesions based on location and tumor size.
Yes, for the surgical treatment, of course, for microinvasive disease, you only need a wide local excision since the risk on lymph node metastasis is extremely low. And for microinvasive unifocal tumors smaller than 4 centimeter, the sentinel node procedure is nowadays indicated. And these patients undergo a radical local excision combined with a uni or bilateral sentinel node biopsy, dependent on the location of the primary tumor. And with such a wide local excision, we usually take a margin of approximately 1 centimeter around the tumor to guarantee tumor-free margins. For lateralized lesions, and in Europe, we define it as more than 1 centimeter from the midline, and I think you define it in the USA as more than 2 centimeters from the midline. So that's different. But we know for the lateralized lesions, only ipsilateral sentinel node identification is necessary. However, we do know from our Grunes V data that about 25% will have bilateral drainage. And in these cases, we will remove the sentinel node in both groins. And for the real midline lesions, and that's what we mean, the lesions that involve the midline, you really need bilateral sentinel node identification. And when you do not find sentinel node, you should perform a lymphadenectomy in the other groin. And then you also have the lesions that are lateralized, so not involving the midline, but they are within 1 centimeter of the midline. And that's what we call the near midline lesions. And in an analysis of all Grunes V1 and Grunes V2 data, we saw that it is safe to perform a unilateral sentinel node procedure in these cases, because we see that when the midline is not involved, about 30% will have only unilateral drainage on the lymphoscintigram. And we saw in our patient that some centers perform contralateral lymphadenectomy in these cases, and some only performed unilateral groin treatment. And we saw in like 150 somewhat patients only very few groin recurrences. And so we think it's safe to, in these cases, accept unilateral lymph flow and only treat that groin.
Yeah, so let's dive in a little bit into the topic of the sentinel lymph node procedure. And in the discussions of the guidelines, one of the questions that came up was, in the case of a unilateral sentinel lymph node metastases, really, how safe is it to omit any treatment to the contralateral groin? And can we safely recommend sparing contralateral treatment even for 4 centimeter tumors or higher?
Overall, I think based on our recent analysis in the Grunes V1 and 2D data, is that you can do only the treatment in the groin with the lymph node metastasis and omit the treatment of the contralateral groin. We saw that the risk of contralateral nodal involvement is about 2 to 3%. So that risk is very low. However, you say even in a tumor of 4 centimeters, well, that's the question. But because, only 20% of our patients will have lymph node metastasis, so we are looking into subgroups. And when we looked at the size of the metastasis, we saw that most of the contralateral nodal involvement in patients with a unilateral positive central node were in patients with tumors larger than 3 centimeters. However, those subgroups were very small, and the difference was not significant, but it was clear that most of them had larger tumors. So we're not sure. I think you should be cautious in these patients and discuss with your patient you should outweigh the risk of the contralateral nodal involvement against the morbidity of the more extensive treatment. And the decision might be different in your 50-year-old patient than in your 85-year-old patient. So we're not sure. It seems like the risk is higher in the larger tumors, but this is the information we have. So we should base our treatment on this.
Very well. So now on a somewhat related topic, isolated tumor cells. And you know, it seems like we treat isolated tumor cells in the sentinel lymph nodes as we treat micrometastases. Is there a real benefit for treating this type of low volume metastases?
Yeah, to be honest, it's also a subject we don't know, because that is also a small category of patients. But I think that the largest database we have on that is the CoreInSphere 1 and CoreInSphere 2 data. And in CoreInSphere 2, we saw that 5% of the patients with tumor cells had additional metastasis at lymphadenectomy. And in CoreInSphere 2, we had categorized those really small metastases as sub micrometastases. So those were the isolated tumor cells and the metastases smaller than 0.2 millimeters. And in total, that were 56 patients, and 11 of them had no additional treatment, and one of them had a groin recurrence. And in the group of patients, the 45 that did have adjuvant treatment, there were no groin recurrences. So also that's not a significant difference, but you cannot say we have enough evidence to not treat these patients with radiotherapy. Of course, radiotherapy to the groin with the 50 gray gives a very few side effects. Morbidity of the treatment is low. However, it can interfere with subsequent treatment when you have a local recurrence. So, that's the information we have, and we still think that therefore you should treat these patients with low volume disease. But when the database becomes larger and we have more information, we finally say, well, we have overtreated these patients, but at this moment, we don't know.
Very well. So now let's talk about those patients that often are treated prior to seeing us. So there are patients who undergo an initial simple vulvectomy, perhaps because of dysplasia, very early presumed disease, and then are found to have depth of invasion more than 1 millimeter. Should sentinel lymph node biopsy be an option for staging in those patients?
Yeah, that's funny, because I know some centers do not do the sentinel node procedure in those patients after they had an excision of the primary tumor, but we never excluded these patients from our CoreInSphere studies. And I know that there are a few studies that looked into this, and they show that the sentinel node procedure can also be safely performed with injection around the scar when the primary tumor was already removed. And we also do that in our patients. We just inject a tracer around the tumor, and you can then have a successful sentinel node procedure. And numbers that are available do not show that these patients have a higher risk of groin recurrence compared to those who are treated in one session. The only thing you have to keep in mind, I think, is that you do not know the exact location of the tumor. Sometimes it might be difficult to say if it was a midline tumor and you should have sentinel node detection in both groins, or that it was a lateralized tumor. So that's what you have to keep in mind, but I think you can safely perform the procedure.
Very well. Now, kind of a curious question. In the ESGO guidelines for the management of patients with cervical cancer, the use of frozen section for the intra-op assessment of the sentinel lymph node is recommended. Now, on the contrary, in the guidelines for vulvar cancer, the frozen section is optional and not recommended. What would be the explanation for these differences?
Yeah, we had a lot of discussion on that in the working group, and because the pathologists are not very fond of frozen sectioning, because they say part of the sentinel node is lost in case you do frozen sectioning, and this is accompanied by the risk of missing metastasis and especially missing micrometastasis, and furthermore, the size of the sentinel node metastasis is also important now in vulvar cancer, because we can now treat patients with a smaller metastasis, smaller than 2 millimeter, with radiotherapy. In the CORIST-V1, we did frozen sectioning because when it was possible, you could immediately do the lymphadenectomy. At this moment, when the metastasis is smaller than 2 millimeter, you want to do radiotherapy. And when it's larger than 2 millimeter, we'll discuss the option of lymphadenectomy or doing chemoradiation in a CORIST-V3 study. So the size is more important, and you don't want to lose tissue, and that is why we advise against frozen sectioning. But some sense also say, well, recently there was a study published that showed that the risk of missing metastasis was low in vulvar cancer. That's not the experience we have, because in the CORIST-V1, 40% of the metastasis was detected with only with ultra staging of the sentinel node. So you don't know how safe it is. And in cervical cancer, the consequences are different, because when you find metastasis, you abort radical hysterectomy and go for primary chemoradiation. So that's different.
Excellent.
Not,
Very well. So,
yeah.
yeah, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. I'm finished.
All right. So I wanted to then kind of go through the process of, like, for example, the sentinel lymph node versus a lymphadenectomy. And in unifocal tumors, a tumor size of 4 centimeters is often set off as a cutoff point to perform lymphadenectomy. Taking into consideration the advances of the sentinel lymph node technique, now the possibility of using ICG, may sentinel lymph node biopsy be considered in tumors greater than 4 centimeters?
Yeah, we are more and more considering to broaden the indications for the sentinel node procedure, because we see, of course, the benefits and much less morbidity for the patients. I don't think ICG is a reason to perform it in large tumors, because, well, the sentinel node detection rate is really high with a radioactive tracer and ICG or blue dye, but I think it almost cannot be better with another tracer. It may be more patient friendly with another tracer, but not a better detection rate. And well, the size of 4 centimeter was once set in the studies that were performed for the sentinel node procedure. In the American study, also patients with larger tumors were included, but we also saw that the sentinel node had higher false negative rates in these patients. At this moment, there's not enough evidence to include larger tumors, but there are studies ongoing now. For example, in Sweden, there's a study including the patients with larger tumors, with multifocal tumors, and with recurrent disease, to see if the sentinel node procedure is safe in these different groups. And also, there's been a study performed in Italy that performed the sentinel node procedure outside the current indications, and then performed a PET-CT preoperative to select the patients, and only included those with a negative PET-CT. And with the PET-CT and the preoperative workup, they had very low false negative rates for the central node. But it was also a small study with about 40 patients. So it's being studied, but I think you should do it within the protection of clinical trials and not broadening indications yourself.
Very well. Now, a lot of times we worry about margins and margin status. And, a lot of times there's this concern about, well, are the margins negative or are these very close margins? This recent update, I think, considers that most relevant are free margins independent of the distance, and that HPV status seems to be a very important indicator or factor. Any comments regarding how to address these situations in consideration of adjuvant treatment?
After we finished the guidelines, all the members of the working group, we could not hear the word margin anymore because we had so much discussion on this subject. Because for long, we considered the 8 millimeter margin as the minimum to minimize the risk on local recurrence. However, more recent studies could not confirm this, including our own study. And we found that the presence of pre-malignant disease, especially differentiated VIN and Langerhans sclerosis, have more influence on the local recurrence rate than the surgical tumor-free margin. I think it's important to get tumor-free margins. And for that, you need a certain surgical margin around the tumor to be sure you remove the tumor in total. But I think when a tumor is like 8 millimeters from the clitoris, you can try to have a smaller margin there in the hope that you remove the tumor with negative margins. So you can spare those structures. The evidence for adjuvant radiotherapy in case of margins smaller than 8 millimeter is very minimal and only based on retrospective data. And I think you should also realize that adjuvant radiotherapy will give you less treatment options in case local recurrences do occur. So we think you should be restrictive in advising adjuvant radiotherapy on the vulva only based on small margins. And focus on the treatment of the pre-malignant disease and closely monitor those patients with differentiated VIN and Langerhans sclerosis because they have the highest risk for local recurrence.
Excellent. Very well. Now, let's talk about something different. Chemotherapy, chemoradiotherapy. When is it indicated in the setting of vulvar cancer?
Yeah, first, the most accepted indication is, I think, the advanced vulvar cancer as an alternative for excentrative surgery. But we also know that chemotherapy is more and more used in combination with radiotherapy in patients that have an indication for radiotherapy to the groins after primary surgery. And we also see in retrospective data that those patients that have chemo radiation do better than those that had radiotherapy alone. But apart from retrospective evidence, we have no prospective data to support the use in specific cases. So at this moment in our guidelines, we say that patients with lymph node metastasis, more than one, or extranodal tumor extension, they do have an indication for radiotherapy to the groins, and you should consider adding chemotherapy in these cases. But we cannot say we recommend it because the evidence is low for that. But of
Very
course,
fine.
we know that in many other cancers, the addition of chemotherapy gives better tumor control.
So now, is considering that chemoradiation therapy is associated with more severe side effects than neoadjuvant chemotherapy alone, is there a subgroup of patients that can benefit from neoadjuvant chemotherapy in order to reduce morbidity?
Yes, we don't know that yet. And first, it will not be chemotherapy alone, but combined with surgery. And The idea of the neoadjuvant chemotherapy is that in advanced vulvar cancer, it will reduce tumor size and thereby make less extensive surgery possible. So when it works, it will probably reduce the morbidity of treatment. And also it gives less severe side effects than neoadjuvant chemo radiation. But when we give chemo radiation in advanced disease, we prefer to give it as in a definitive dose and not as a neoadjuvant treatment. And of course, sometimes you need additional surgery because the tumor is not completely gone, but we prefer to give it in a radical dose to give it as a definitive treatment. And evidence on neoadjuvant chemotherapy is scarce, and we must realize that the best numbers show about 70% response rate, and ones that do not respond might progress even further, making treatment more difficult. And in the Netherlands, we just started the Falconeye study, and that's a study including patients with advanced vulvar cancer who will be randomized between neoadjuvant chemotherapy or primary chemo radiation. And this study will hopefully learn us more on the effectiveness and the safety of neoadjuvant chemotherapy in advanced vulvar cancer. And in my opinion, this treatment is now still experimental, and we should evaluate it within the protection of a prospective trial, as we are doing now. So hopefully we will know more in a few years.
Excellent. Now, Maggie, we have actually had several manuscripts published in our journal on electrochemotherapy. Could this be a valid option for patients who underwent extensive treatment of primary surgery or patients who are not suitable for surgery?
Yes, I know very little about electrochemotherapy, and there are only a few centers, mainly in Italy, that perform this treatment. It may have a role in palliative management of vulvar cancer, especially when surgery and radiotherapy are no longer applicable. But the studies that are published show good results, and the doctors that perform electrochemotherapy say they can very well palliate patients with this treatment. But I've never seen it. No, we do not perform it in our country.
Okay. Now, fortunately, we don't see many patients with this, but what should be the approach for recurrence of an ulcerated inguinal femoral lymph node that is not suitable for surgery after chemoradiotherapy?
Yeah, that is a very bad situation, of which we all agree that's a palliative situation. Palliative chemotherapy might be an option, but we know that the role of systemic agents in palliative setting in the treatment of vulvar cancer is very limited. And you can give palliative radiotherapy in selected cases, and radiotherapy can give pain relief or temporary regression with cessation of bleeding. And I think you should give pain control and a palliative care plan, but it's not a stage of disease you can cure at that moment.
Yeah. Now, turning to the point of systemic therapy for recurrent disease, obviously now standard for recurrent cervix is carboplatin, paclitaxel, pembrolizumab, and bevacizumab. Should we be adopting this regimen for advanced or recurrent vulvar cancer?
Yeah, for advanced and recurrent vulvar cancer, we don't have standard systemic therapy, and there are very few studies exploring systemic therapy in metastatic vulvar cancer. So data from cervical cancer are usually extrapolated. For now, you're right. Platinum-based combination chemotherapy is considered first line, and best combined with paclitaxel, I think. And based on cervical cancer, you can add pembrolizumab in case of PD-L1 expression. But these drugs do not have a specific approval in vulvar cancer, at least not in our country.
So now, I wanted to conclude, certainly, although rarely used, supportive and palliative care is essential in the management of patients with vulvar cancer. What are the challenges to full implementation of these critical interventions, and how do you think we can overcome these barriers?
Yeah, I think supportive care should be offered to all patients, and a palliative care plan should start at the moment you know curative treatment is not an option anymore. And we know the diagnosis and the treatment of vulvar cancer can have significant physical and psychological impact on women, and it's essential that the potential consequences of treatment are discussed before and following treatment. Like psychological concerns, lymphedema, altered sexual functioning, body image, and also after radiotherapy, possible altered bowel and bladder function. And yeah, I think these challenges are much easier to overcome when the care of these patients is centralized, so we get back to where we started. I really think this is the first essential step towards better care for vulvar cancer patients because, yeah, structural supportive care is much more difficult to arrange for an indication you see 4 or 5 times per year than when you have much more patients and you have experience with the side effects of the treatment and the consequences of treatment. And I really think you should early integrate palliative care. Because that has also shown to give better symptom control, better quality of life, more clarity regarding goals of care at the end of life. And yeah, I think every patient deserves this when curative treatment is not an option anymore.
Well, thank you so much, Maike Onk, for your time, and of course, obviously, for accepting our invitation to discuss these guidelines. And really, truly, congratulations to you and the rest of the team for obviously, it's a daunting task to address this topic, a rare tumor, and certainly, we appreciate this contribution to the literature as gynecologic oncologists.
Thank you too. Thank you for inviting me for this. It was an honor.